Welcome to the World of Intelligence, a podcast for you to discover the latest analysis of global military and security trends within the open source defense intelligence community. Now onto the episode with your host, Harry Kemsley.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of World of Intelligence by James with your host as usual, Harry Kemsley. And I'm pleased to welcome back Sean Corbett as my co-host. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Harry. It's good to be back.
Good to see you again. We last time, in your absence, talked about the difficult situation that is ongoing in the Middle East around Israel and on that occasion, Hezbollah and Lebanon. And we had Elliot Chapman and Guraj Ghanasan with us last time. And I'm delighted to say they're back for a second episode on the same topic. So, Elliot, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Harry. Hi, Sean.
And Suraj, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Harry. Hi, Sean. Good to be back.
Now, since we last spoke, I had quite a bit of feedback from listeners to the podcast episode we did last time, thanking us for the insights that we brought and also some of the summaries that we provided, Guraj. So that was all good. What we're going to do today is bring us up to date with where we got to from the last conversation. There were a couple of specifics that we left the last episode with, which we'll examine in just a moment. And Sean, with you back in the room, look to you to sort of bring the conversation up to the more strategic geopolitical level as well, as we look at some of the tactical details that we necessarily need to look at. So when we last spoke, just to very briefly summarize, we identified the background, thank you Siraj, to this, the genesis of this situation and the major events. We looked at the apparent strategy of the Israeli Defense Force, interdicting multiple tiers in the Hezbollah structure from the strategic down to the tactical. We also observed that some of the impact on the tactical environment appeared to be, at that stage, 2 weeks ago, relatively slight in that the intensity was being maintained by Hezbollah. So it'd be interesting to see whether that's been maintained. And we were looking to see where this was going in terms of over the next 2 weeks, will we see any sustainment, any increased escalation, any spread of this conflict, other involvements and so on. So with that summary, Elliot and Siraj, you can just give me a one grunt for yes, two grunts for no. Does that summarize what you recall from the last conversation?
Yep, absolutely.
Good. Siraj, just a quick thumbs up from you as well. Good stuff. Yeah. All right. So, Elliot, let me come to you first this time in terms of the Israeli perspective. What has Israel been seeking to achieve since we last spoke? What are we seeing in terms of tactics? And are there any expansions of the IDF operations, which last time we spoke were relatively contained and targeted? What have we been seeing over the last 2 weeks?
So I think actually what we've been seeing is quite kind of consistent with where we were last week. So in terms of what Israel's been doing, it's been conducting kind of targeted raids, going after specific Hezbollah infrastructure, seems to be quite intelligence led. So they're going after areas that they've kind of pre-identified as having, you know, high concentrations of Hezbollah infrastructure. And that infrastructure seems to be generally more focused on Hezbollah's Radwan force, which is it's kind of elite commando raiding style force, which of course poses the kind of the immediate threat to Israeli citizens in the north of the country, which of course these forces could potentially conduct a kind of Hamas 7th of October style raid. So that's been the kind of the nightmare scenario for Israel for a long time. And they're kind of seeking to actively degrade, and I'll use that word as sparingly as possible, these kind of particular threatening capabilities that are positioned right on the border with Israel. And so where we were last week was pretty much there. Where we are this week is still kind of at the front line, let's call it, in a similar place. We're just seeing a slow sort of movement of where these areas are that are being targeted. So Israeli forces are kind of, I guess, indicating that they're happy with the clearance of one area, moving to the next. But we're not seeing any kind of extension to the depth of these operations. They're still quite close to the border in terms of the ground operations that are taking place. Although, you know, they're moving sort of where they're taking place along the border. And what the kind of the tactics involved in these raids are kind of similar to what we've seen in the Gaza Strip. So a lot of these units, in fact, all the units that we've recorded that are operating in southern Lebanon have had prior experience in the Gaza Strip, conducting similar style operations of finding tunnel underground infrastructure and destroying it. And we're seeing sort of the potential expansion to areas of the northeast of Israel and the southeast of Lebanon, with kind of things like, you know, demining operations by the IDF. It looks like they're kind of clearing areas to get ready to kind of potentially expand ground operations in that area. In terms of the different echelons that we spoke about last time, sort of the kind of the real logistics, strategic level stuff and the headquarters, it looks like there's been a little bit of a slowdown in terms of strikes in Beirut over the last week, although we've seen kind of some of those still occurring. But the sort of high intensity strikes that we saw at the start of this conflict, that seems to have kind of slowed down a little bit for now.
Okay. All right. So let's turn, Suresh, to you then, in terms of, we've heard from Elliot what we think we're seeing from an Israeli perspective. And of course, gents, in a while, we'll come back to how are we seeing these things? What are the sources you're using from the open environment that allows you to make these statements? Come back to that later. Suresh, what are we seeing since the beginning of October in terms of trends in the attacks? And what are the indicators in terms of the capability of Hezbollah from these Israeli tactics?
Well, Harry, I think we are seeing somewhat of, you know, largely the same things, you know, what we saw last week. You know, Israeli forces, like Elliot said, you know, they're conducting special raids and targeted clearing operations. And just to put some numbers to Elliot's assessments, I think in the past week, there have been verified reports of at least two targeted raids on Radwan headquarters, where Israeli forces have seized mortars and ATGMs, IEDs, and, you know, landmines and things like that. So, yeah, just to add on Elliot's you know, assessments over here, it seems to be largely the same, and Hezbollah forces continue to avoid a lot of, you know, close combat with Israeli forces. What we are seeing is firing of ATGMs from a distance and a lot of IEDs being planted along where Israeli forces are operating.
Okay. Now, when we spoke last time, as I mentioned in my summary at the beginning, we talked about this multi-tier strategy that appeared to be in place with the Israelis. We talked about the fact that they were clearly going after the executive leadership and taking out some critical capabilities, potentially breaking down that command and control loop that certainly in traditional military force you would assume would degrade capability. And we wonder whether that would start to be the case for Hezbollah. Have we seen anything like that, Suresh, from your experience? Sean, before I come to you, Suresh?
Yeah, in terms of, you know, addressing degradation of capabilities, you know, there are a few points we must address first. You know, the first being in terms of, you know, Nasrallah, the former Secretary General of Hezbollah, has stated numerous times or issued threats that Hezbollah would fire thousands of rockets a day, you know, into Israel. And, you know, a lot of assessments that we see around also shed light to that, you know, of Hezbollah increasing the range and number of you know, missiles fired into northern Israel. But at this stage, I just want to, you know, bring into question the capability of Hezbollah to even do that. Sure, we know that since the 2006 war, you know, they've increased their stockpiles, with certain estimates putting it between 100,000 and 200,000 rockets, missiles, and mortars. But whether, you know, they have the capability to fire thousands a day is you know, questionable at best. You know, this would also assume that Israel would do nothing about it, which is not the case, because, you know, on 25th August, hours before Hezbollah was about to conduct retaliation attacks for the killing of Fuad Shukr, you know, Israel conducted preemptive strikes on Hezbollah assets. So to say that Hezbollah would, you know, somehow ratchet up the attacks to fire 1,000 rockets a day is questionable. And secondly, in terms of their, you know, something pointing towards the degradation of their capabilities is that we know from September 17th onwards, Israel has conducted an accelerated air campaign that has taken out a lot of key Hezbollah commanders. You know, this would be from the Nasser unit, Aziz unit operating in the Southern Command Front, and also the overall head of the Southern Command Front, which is Ali Karaki, and also the overall head of the Radwan unit, Ibrahim Akil, along with Nasrallah as well. So, you know, it appears right now that Hezbollah does not have the executive command to manage the stockpile and issue orders to fire thousands of rockets a day. The most we've recorded so far is 300, 350 rockets that were conducted in retaliation to killing of senior commanders. A third interesting indicator towards degradation of weapon stockpiles or capabilities is, Hezbollah's lack of use of anti-aircraft weapons. So in July of this year, we published a report on Hezbollah's use of anti-aircraft weapons. And since October 2023 to July 2024, we have at least six verified instances where Hezbollah used anti-aircraft weapons to shoot down Israeli drones and UAVs. But since July, we have not seen even one. And out of the six that were taken down, at least three were in Nabatieh and southern governorates of Lebanon. And Israel continues to operate UAVs in southern Lebanon. And we don't see, usage of anti-aircraft weapons by Hezbollah. That would point towards potential degradation of, certain capabilities, among the group. And, a last point that I would like to highlight is a lack of a discernible change in tactics, techniques, and procedures, before and after an Israeli operation or airstrike is also a key indicator that could point towards a degradation of Hezbollah capabilities. They are still conducting mass fire attacks, use of UAVs and mortars, but there hasn't been much change in techniques or procedures, beyond that.
Right. Just before I come back to you, Elliot, just a second, in terms of any implications of what you just heard from an Israeli perspective. Sean, help us start to see this situation in a slightly different perspective, as well as any comments you've got about the tactical environment.
Yeah, and Suraj just teed me up very nicely on this one. So that there's effectively the strategic intent here is to write down Hezbollah, to make it, and this is potentially terminal Hezbollah. What's happening at the tactical level basically is to stop Israeli citizens being attacked through rockets and all the rest of it. So that it's almost an enabler, if you like. But what's really going on here is writing down the command and control of Hezbollah in such a way that it will take years and years for them to reconstitute, even if they can at all. And we'll come back and talk to that in a minute, because Hezbollah is a political organization, a political terrorist organization with a military arm or pseudo military arm, if you like. So with Nasrallah going and the combination of, in terms of pure military capability and execution, it was brilliant. It's what you and I would call reinforcing success. So Nasrallah gone, the pager operation, which, timing was interesting. I think they had to do it because they were probably about to get rumbled on that. But what it did is it brought up a lot of the second and tertiary command structure up on the net, which was expected, and they are now being targeted. So you're taking not just, as we've always done in counterterrorism, you take the bad guy out. Oh, excellent. Well done. Mowing the grass as we know it. This is actually far deeper. So we're going down three and four levels. So the command and control is blown, basically. What that means as well, from a sort of continuation piece, is that the commanders that are left that have to be seen to be doing stuff politically are coming up on the net, and they're getting taken out as well, which is why you're seeing quite a lot of unusual air activity in terms of why they're attacking there, because they've clearly got a handle on these people. Yeah. So there's as much that going on. And then there's the sustainability piece as well. So just analysing some of the imagery that's coming out there on explosions, there are a lot of secondaries. You can see, so the Big Bang goes off to take out whatever it happens to be, and then you see a huge secondary, which is a lot more than just the impact of that specific weapon. So they're clearly targeting what they know as armories, all the rest of it. So that then begs you in the question is, okay, what have they got left? Now, I think that Hezbollah are putting everything they can into it just to be shown to be still, in the game, if you like. That's not going to happen for much longer, I don't think. And I think things are going to tail off.
All right. Well, if we look for that tail off, as you put it, Sean, and I'll come back to you in a moment in terms of the wider impact, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of the strategic geopolitical dimension. Elliot, you wanted to come back on something that Siraj was saying earlier. We'll come back to you then.
Yeah, just I guess to link into Sean's point as well, and Siraj's subsequent before that. I think the interesting point, what Siraj was saying about what we're sort of tracking on a day-to-day basis, is that, before and after this, this major sort of air campaign by Israel, we're seeing just almost a continuation of the day-to-day level of intensity of attacks, let's call it, by Hezbollah. And I think that in itself is quite interesting from the perspective of we didn't see a sort of a huge drop or a violent increase either. And I think the lack of a violent change to, you know, reactive, let's call it, change to attack is kind of indicating that these massive attacks that have decapitated large portions of Hezbollah's command and control, that there's no sort of almost no feedback. That's what it seems to see to indicate to me, that commanders at the sort of the tactical frontline level are just doing what they can, it seems, really, which is what they have been doing, and that there's no additional support, you know, coming their way, really.
Yeah, almost in the absence of any new direction given, do what you've been told to do previously and keep doing it if it's possible to do. So, Siraj and Elliot, I'm going to come back to you in just a moment to talk about. So, as before, what are you using as your sources? Any change? Any update from the open sources that you're accessing to help you understand what's happening on the ground? Are there any particular nuances of this conflict which are worth mentioning to the audience who are interested in the power and utility of open sources? But before I go to that, Elliot and Siraj, let me come back to you, Sean, in terms of, as you said right at the beginning and mentioned a moment ago, the wider perspective. What does this conflict mean more strategically?
Okay, you know that I like to, when I'm studying anything, get whichever country that I'm considering in the middle of a map. It's fascinating. As soon as you see it, think, right. And you can use that for any country, Russia. But if you look at it from an Israeli perspective, they felt, and they have been in many respects, surrounded by Iranian proxies for years and years and years. So this is all in the context of Israel versus Iran here. Hezbollah, as you know, are a proxy force for the IRGC. Yes, they've got their own political requirements, but actually, even back to where they came from originally, was a Iranian proxy. And their explicit aim is to exterminate the Israeli state. So you look at that from a perspective of both Iran and then the other proxies within Gaza, West Bank, etc., and you realize that actually Israel feel incredibly threatened. So before they, and this is a sequence thing, before they start retaliating on Iran, which will happen, you know, they need to secure the more border areas, but also the feeding of the arms and the training and all the rest of it from the IRGC. So this is almost enabling function. If they can write down the Hezbollah threat to the extent that the rockets are going to be manageable, because they're always going to be, you know, the odd piece here, they've pretty much neutralized for a while anyway the Gaza threat, you know, next step Iran. And so what they're trying to do is making sure Iran cannot open a front if there happens to be extreme escalation between Iran and Israel. So this is a really interesting time, and the potential for miscalculation or indeed intentional activity to expand it is real right now.
Yeah.
So that's the strategic context. In terms of Lebanon itself, as I said before, you know, Hezbollah are a sort of quasi-political organization. In fact, not quasi, because they actually have, I think it's at least three, that might be more than that, actually, politicians within the Lebanese government. They've kind of got their own quasi-state down the south, where there's no love lost really for Hezbollah, but Nasrallah in particular put in many social enablers in terms of schools and all sorts of things, which has had to actually profited the very poor and neglected southern people. So he's had that support base, albeit from a perspective as a whole Lebanon, as look, we have to put up with these because they have got the forces that would well overwhelm the Lebanese armed forces, et cetera, et cetera. So writing them down is not necessarily the worst thing for the Lebanese existing government, the actual government, or the Lebanese people themselves, which is why I say this could be existential for Hezbollah. So that's on the Lebanese side. But really, we need to look at this perspective between Iran versus Israel.
All right. Well, perhaps when we come back to this conversation another time, we should have a conversation about the wider implication for the GCC countries, for example, who have an equally large concern about their neighbour to the north, and maybe then broader still. But we'll come back to that. Let me come to you first, Siraj, because I want to tack on to that question I had a moment ago about sources and what you're doing in the open source environment to help you understand what's happening on the ground. I want to tack on to that a question about the government of Lebanon and their military forces, which we haven't heard or seen very much of, and we think we mentioned it briefly last time. What are the prospects of the government of Lebanon and its own armed forces actually taking this as an opportunity to step into the void that is being potentially created around Hezbollah, so they can actually start to superimpose themselves where perhaps the legitimate government should be. So the first part of the question is open source. How are you doing it? What are you looking at? Anything about this conflict that makes it different? And then second, just tacked onto that, are there any signs from open sources about the government of Lebanon and how they might seek an opportunity from what's happening to Hezbollah?
So addressing your first question in terms of sources, you know, we touched upon this a little bit in the last podcast as well. It's, you know, looking at Hezbollah statements, IDF statements. Of course, there's going to be a lot of discrepancies. That's where you use your knowledge of the country, of the forces and, you know, operating in the country to ascertain what's happening. A lot of Lebanese, local Lebanese sources as well, although they're biased, you know, we can get a certain idea of what's happening. You know, usually a lot of exaggeration claims come from, you know, in terms of casualties on the ground. So that's much harder to ascertain. You know, Hezbollah, of course, in terms of civilian casualties following Israeli airstrikes, Hezbollah usually tend to, you know, inflate the, you know, the number of dead or injured. And, you know, similarly, you have the IDF sometimes, you know, maybe, you know, not even putting out these statistics. But yeah, it's you know, you got to rely on Israeli local media, Lebanese local media, corroborate the information, you know, along with the statements, and also, you know, the government-affiliated media, you know, they also put out a lot of statements in terms of Israeli attacks and things like that. And recently, since the, you know, ground incursion began, I've also been looking at UNIFIL statements that indicate, you know, where Israeli forces are operating and, you know, maybe some attacks on UNIFIL positions might not be intended from Israeli forces. So, yeah, those are some of the sources that I've been using.
Okay, very good. So is there anything in those sources you're using that gives you any sense of what the Lebanese government might be looking at in terms of opportunity or indeed risk to them for what's happening with Israel?
Well, I cannot speak militarily because there hasn't been much indications of involvement of Lebanese forces or how they are viewing the issue. Of course, they are not happy about the Israeli incursion, and that's been very evident. But politically speaking, you know, Lebanon has been without a president for the last 2 years. So there's been a push from within Lebanon and also from outside actors like France, Saudi Arabia and the United States to elect a president because, you know, Hezbollah and their allies, they have 15 seats out of 128 seats in the Lebanese parliament. And, you know, Hezbollah's key ally, the Amal movement, also have 15 seats. So that's a total of 30 on the 128 seats in the Lebanese parliament. And for the last 2 years, Hezbollah has been, you know, pushing Sleiman Frangieh, who is a Hezbollah ally and also an ally to the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad. Hezbollah has been pushing Frangieh to be the president of Lebanon. Meanwhile, the opposing Christian blocs, they've been pushing Jihad Azur. You know, he's their main candidate. He is not a representative of any Lebanese political party. So, you know, he would be a neutral party. And since the ground incursion began and Hezbollah has been significantly weakened militarily, which is very likely, following the Israeli operations, there's been a push to elect a new president. But, you know, it's unlikely that would happen in the immediate to short term because there are a lot of moving parts. We did have the caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati come out release a statement saying that he's working with the Shiite Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri to work with the other political parties in Lebanon to elect a president. And in the statement he suggested that they are looking to elect a president who doesn't represent a challenge to anyone. Not sure what that means, not sure who the ideal candidate for that would be. So like I said, a lot of complications. But yeah, there is some, if I can call it that, an indication that, you know, they want to move towards electing a president.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, we'll come back to that point later. Let me come to you now, Elliot, in terms of, again, your approach to the open source environment, any changes, any nuances that you've been using or seeing. And then from there, I think what we'll do there is we'll start to look forward, a bit of foresight. Just like we did at the end of last time, what do we think the next couple of weeks is going to do to this environment? What can we look for in terms of indicators? So, Elliot, I'll come to you last on that question. But first, let's talk about the open source environment you're working with.
I think my answers kind of remain similar to last week, with, mm-hmm. with one perhaps slight nuance, which is, you know, so I think what I described last week was we, as Suraj did, we sort of have a good understanding of the local media environment, and we have a good understanding of primary sources, you know, the way that, that sort of government or military organizations or whoever they are kind of messaging. And then there's this kind of the more sort of nitty gritty social media, you know, looking at sort of what's coming through feeds from militant organizations or that kind of thing. And then other kind of tangential, sort of perhaps non, strictly speaking, directly related to the topic, but we can use to kind of support our analysis, you know, geospatial data, that kind of thing.
Right.
I think what one thing that I'm looking at right now is monitoring Israeli casualties. We're kind of looking at, you know, we're kind of in a unique situation where actually the Israeli government's quite open about, you know, daily numbers of who is dying in which theatres. And, you know, we get insight into what units they're from. And this has also been kind of, in retrospect as well, very helpful for looking at kind of combat intensity in Gaza as well, and that kind of thing. So we saw to that point, a kind of in the first opening days of the conflict, of the ground conflict in southern Lebanon, a kind of quite a bad couple of first days. But since then, we've sort of seen a much sort of a slower number of IDF killed. So that's a kind of another thing, for example, that we're building our own sort of data sets on to monitor.
Great. All right. So thank you for that. Let's then start stepping towards, as I said a moment ago, foresight. I'll come to you first of all, Suraj. What are you going to be looking for over the next week or two before we come back and do a third version of this this topic? What are the things you're expecting to see? And what will you be looking for? I'll come to the same question for you, Elliot, from the Israeli perspective. And then, Sean, I'll come back to you on the same question in terms of the slightly more strategic perspective. Suresh first.
Yeah, Hari. On the ground in southern Lebanon, I think we are going to continue to see more of the same. While Hezbollah attempts to, you know, reorganize and rebuild the organization, especially the executive command, so that, you know, they can get things running. So, you know, until that happens, with the ongoing Israeli air and ground campaign, we are going to see, you know, use of IEDs, landmines, mortars, you know, ATGMs on Israeli forces. And it's from Hezbollah, it's going to be more of the same, but on the ground. But, you know, Hezbollah attacks into northern Israel, you know, that offers an interesting insight. So, you know, Hezbollah on 13th October, they conducted what we would call a significant attack, you know, targeting the Binyamina town in Haifa district. They launched multiple UAVs targeting the IDF's Jolani Brigade, and the attack killed 4 IDF members and injured at least 58 others. So, you know, that's a significant number since October 2023. And Hezbollah, following the attack, they stated that they are going to target IDF rear positions in northern Israel and support lines, part of its defense against Israeli ground incursion into southern Lebanon. So what we are going to see is more of that, you know, massed fires, 80 to 100 rockets, or maybe even several hundred rockets, unguided, rockets into northern Israel to overwhelm Israeli air defense systems. Meanwhile, you know, at the same time, they would fire maybe precision missiles or UAVs to target key Israeli infrastructure or IDF positions to cause some sort of casualties. And, you know, that would enable them to then say, yeah, no matter, you know, what the IDF does, even within the ongoing ground incursion, we are still able to attack northern Israel, and we will still make sure that northern Israeli civilians are not able to come back, which is, you know, basically the broader objective of this ground offensive into southern Lebanon by the IDF.
Understood. And I guess just before I come to you, Elliot, from the Israeli perspective, I guess if we see that the amount of activity doesn't sustain from Hezbollah, then our hypothesis that they have been degraded in terms of command and control, and as Sean was saying, with the weapons caches presumably being targeted, that they're actually being degraded in terms of available materiel as well. So we'll look for that indication the next time we speak. Elliot, turning to you then, what are you expecting to see from the Israeli perspective? Anything that you can foresee from what you're seeing out of open sources?
Yeah, I think in terms of indicators, it's sort of directly showing us kind of what's going to happen in the future. It's hard to tell, but I think I can kind of perhaps analyze it from a broader Israeli kind of interest and their how they've kind of operated in the past. And I think, you know, the Israeli government, this particular government, and the Israeli kind of military forces are not really going to settle, I think, for a situation where they've done sort of a half job of degrading Hezbollah's frontline capabilities. So I think that they will continue to try and see that through, that they can kind of say to domestic Israeli audience, you know, we have materially degraded these underground bunkers and complexes, and of course, you know, done massive damage to the organization's stockpiles, command and control, all that kind of that stuff. And so I think we're going to see the continuation of this conflict. I don't think the degradation of those capabilities is in and of itself the ultimate goal, because, of course, as Sean mentioned, it's never going to fully create a kind of, you know, totally secure environment for Israel. And actually, so that the ultimate goal is kind of a political one, I think, for Israel, that they're going to seek to kind of degrade Hezbollah to the point where they're happy that any subsequent political agreement is actually going to be enough to kind of guarantee security for a while and buy them a lot of runway to then, I think, perhaps look to the conflict in a broader sense that I think Sean might be mentioning or has mentioned as well.
All right, Elliot, thank you. Sean, over to you. What are your thoughts about the imminent future in this conflict area?
Yeah, I agree with a lot that's been said there, actually. You're never going to completely get rid of the threat on the border, but it's going to be, I think, more opportunistic. And you're not going to get rid of all the weapons either. So pop-ups that aren't particularly targeted. What will be interesting is if they are effective in terms of some sort of tactical, right, we're aiming for the military or just terror weapons into civilians. But as I said before, that all that context is to try and reduce that threat for bigger things. So it, you know, it's pretty significant that the US have deployed THAAD system now and are manning it to kind of reduce that threat, because there is a sequence to here. And you know, even Israel with its military might can't really effectively fight a war on three fronts, just in terms of the enablers. So reducing the threat on its immediate borders in preparation for whatever it's going to do in Iran. Now, almost certainly there's been a trade-off and a deal between the Israelis and the US to say, look, the US will say, we'll help you and we'll support you in return for, and the humanitarian thing is important, obviously, but it's mainly, you know, just calibrate your response to Iran. And there's a lot of reporting right now that they've agreed, you know, not to have a go at the nuclear systems or even the oil because of the global implications of that. How true that is, I don't know. But the Israelis will do something significant, but not above the red line, if you like to call it that. And don't underestimate the Iranians are worried. They really are. So both the leadership and the population is worried about the extent of the retaliation. They know that Israel could give them a real bloody nose if they wanted to. So if you look at the context, right, you know, we've now written down your proxies. We're coming after you unless you start behaving yourself. And that's really the big message that's being thrown out here. So in terms of strategically, what they're trying to do is slap Iran sufficiently to say, stop it, just stop doing what you're doing. And there have been strikes in Syria from some of the logistics nodes that have been supplying both Hezbollah and no longer Gaza, but Hezbollah as well. So it's all enabling and shaping to send that huge political message. We're serious now to Iran. Stop doing what you're doing.
All right. Thank you for that. Let me offer this then as the summary of where we're going to go next. I think it will be very useful the next time we do this in a week or two's time, if we first of all look to see whether we've seen any degradation in terms of the sustainment of the Hezbollah activity, which, as I said earlier, might indicate that they have been written down more than they would like to admit, whether or not we see any changes earlier in terms of the Israeli tactics or apparent strategy, and then Sean, the impact that's having on the wider. Clearly, if anything were to occur of a more strategic implication, then we'll bring the next podcast immediately forward and we'll do it around that, especially if Israel do something spectacular into Iran or anywhere else. What I would like to do next time, though, is I'd like to bring together the conflicts of this particular campaign, as you said, Sean, they're not separate wars. They are part of the same overall war that Israel is fighting. When you look at Israel, look at it from Israeli's perspective, they're just threats to their north and northeast. So let's look at Gaza situation on that. Let's look at the situation into Lebanon and potentially the wider forum into Iran particularly. Let's not, however, next time overlook the impact it's having on the civilian population. We mentioned on the first episode of this, the migration of people perhaps back to Syria who had previously come from Syria to avoid conflict there, now finding themselves in another war zone, going back to their homes. Let's have a look specifically at what's happening on the ground from a civilian perspective, because as always is the case with wars, it's the civilian populations that feel the brunt of it whilst the military go about their deadly business. So, Elliot, Suraj, thank you for coming back a second time, and thank you in advance for coming back on a third. Sean, good to see you back in the room and joining the conversation. But without further ado, thank you all for this second episode in this difficult situation in Lebanon, and thank you in advance for the third. For our listeners, as ever, if you have any questions, comments, or any particular topics you'd like us to cover, please do reach out to us. We're easy to find through the Jane's website, and you can send us a message, which some people have been doing, more of which another time. Thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on The World of Intelligence. Make sure to visit our website, janes.com/podcast, where you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.